Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, the sun grows a little dimmer for Germany's solar subsidies.
As of the beginning of April, Germany has slashed its incentives for new solar investments by 30%.
Also coming up, the growing insurance costs of extreme weather events, and we hear from one country that's especially hard hit right now.
At this time of year, Narcisa's farm usually produces healthy and profitable quantities of beans, corn, pumpkin and bananas. But not this year.
And we'll also hear how this year's Earth Hour went down in Berlin at the weekend.
I'm Hector, I'm from Colombia.
And why did you guys come down tonight?
Well, I guess it's quite a remarkable moment during the year, where everybody just try to do something for the planet.
That and more still to come. I'm Nathan Witkop. Welcome to the show. Last year, Germany installed a whopping 7.5 gigawatts of new solar panels. According to the International Energy Agency, that was nearly as much as the rest of the world combined, and it's potentially the equivalent of 7.5 nuclear plants. For a country with a third of the sunlight of Spain, the solar industry is booming, or perhaps bubbling, say its critics. This week, Qcells became the fourth German solar company to apply for bankruptcy since December, amid plummeting prices for solar panels and reductions to incentives. So is the sun rising or setting on Germany's solar experiment? Jonathan Gifford set out to find out more.
Last month, on a clear day in Berlin, 12,000 demonstrators gathered before the Brandenburg Gate to protest an expected government decision to radically cut subsidies for solar power. The protesters were overwhelmingly from the solar industry, which midway through last year employed over 100,000 people in Germany. Companies like the American First Solar bussed in much of its workforce from nearby Frankfurt Oder. The blue logos of module manufacturer Qcells were also prominent, as were tradesmen, engineers and investors. Not your usual environmental protest suspects.
Oder sollte man besser sagen, gegen das Energiewende-Verhinderungsprogramm.
For months, the government, and especially members of the junior coalition partner, the Free Democrats, had been saying that Germany's feed-in tariffs for the solar industry were too high. It said that the solar market was overheated and that the public was bearing too much of the cost. Though the blow didn't arrive that day in Berlin, it has subsequently. As of the beginning of April, Germany has slashed its incentives for new solar investments by 30%.
Der PV-Branche aus Industrie, Handel und Handwerk sind heute nach Berlin gekommen.
Well, I wouldn't actually call these changes sudden. I would call them should have been expected.
Paula Mintz is a solar industry expert for Navigant, a consulting company.
So no incentive is designed to last forever. They're all designed to essentially stimulate a market. When a market in any just one country grows this fast, I would assume that the people who design the incentives can assume that the market has been stimulated, and thus they bring it down, 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 down.
Germany's solar industry is booming thanks to its system of feed-in tariffs. These require utilities to buy any renewable energy offered to them at a guaranteed minimum price for vendors. The prices are designed to come down over time, but the price of solar panels has fallen so dramatically, about 40%, thanks in part to cheap competition from China, that homeowners, farmers and businesses have rushed to install photovoltaic panels on their roofs. Heiko Schwarzberger, a solar engineer, says the tariffs have become a victim of their own success.
What we see in Germany and Italy and France and everywhere in the world is that the feed-in tariffs decline dramatically, and that means that the states and the politicians, they draw back from the support. And this is the right time to get some economic rules in this business. You know, and this is what we see and what we expect in the next months, that photovoltaics will play a major role in the energy business on an economic scale and not on a political scale.
The cuts to the tariff seem to slow down the pace of investment. But with the fall in prices for solar panels and feed-in tariffs, some German solar companies have been just as quick to plummet. Solon was the first to go, followed by the developer Solar Hybrid, and just this week manufacturer Qcells declared insolvency. But some in the solar industry say the cuts to the sector's tariffs are not just about economics. Engineer Christian Steinberg from the firm Solar Praxis was at an industry meeting in Vienna last week, arguing that the cuts are also aimed at appeasing the big power companies in Germany.
The people still support photovoltaics, and they are also willing to pay a premium on the electricity bill for a sustainable energy supply. But of course, the business model of the utilities is threatened by photovoltaics, and we see that the cutbacks in the feed-in tariff and also the caps on the system size are designed to cap the installed power, the newly installed power. It's not really about cost cutting.
Heiko Schwarzberger says the rapid growth of solar energy, supplied by anyone with a solar panel on their roof, is posing a challenge to the big energy companies. Increasingly, they are unable to gain the maximum profit out of expensive power plants because renewables are meeting much of the demand at the most lucrative times of the day.
The beginning of the economic competition is in times when electricity is really expensive, and this is over today, and in Germany it's the same as in India or the United States, at about noon. Yeah, and this is perfect by the yield a photovoltaic equipment gives you to the net. And this is what we already see. Last year we had some days and weeks when photovoltaic and the wind energy reduced the prices in the energy exchange in Leipzig. So this is what we call the merit order effect, and we are just at the beginning to gain from this effect.
Germany and countries with significant amounts of renewable energy are beginning to see the merit order effect kick in, renewables actually reducing the cost of electricity. Despite declining tariffs and market consolidation, many in the industry remain bright about its future. Jürgen Pfaff is from RPV, a solar components supplier. He says there's bound to be some pain for companies ahead, but growth and opportunity continue to await the clever.
The module producers, they are crying now, of course, and I think you have to look forward to the future and think positively. The situation isn't good, but it doesn't help to cry about. So you have to take a chance and say, okay, let's do it. We are on the right way. The future is ours. But we have to get a common standard in Germany, in the world, in Europe. And the future is ours. There is no other chance.
Jonathan Gifford had that report there. Well, Latvia might not spring to mind as a hub for solar technology, but the small Baltic nation may have come up with a technology that could boost solar panels' efficiency considerably. Though Latvia produces hardly any solar power for itself, one company there hopes to cash in on its new technique of coating photovoltaic panels. Gerards Gelzis reports from Riga.
Latvia is known for long and dark months of winter and autumn, rather long periods of rain and often cloudy skies in spring and summer. So it's a bit surprising that some of the latest cutting-edge solar panel technology would come from here. But an American-owned company, Groglass, has been hard at work for the past few years. Since 2009, the company has been producing anti-reflective coatings on glass for use in greenhouses, construction and other areas. Recently, though, Groglass began work on a special glass coating used in the solar or PV panels. It was finally released late last year. Juris Oleņiks is a Groglass spokesperson.
It's a nano coating, which enables the glass to transmit more light wavelengths. There are 4 to 6 ultra-thin sheets, which consist of metal oxides, and the thickness of the layer is just 1/400th of a human hair. So it is indeed very thin.
The ultra-thin layer of metal oxides is coated on glass using a special vacuum coating method called magnetron sputtering. It is the only technique how the metal oxides which form the anti-reflective coating can be reduced to atomic level and evenly applied on the glass surface. While scientists across Europe have been pioneering magnetron sputtering for years, this is the first time it has made it into a commercially available solar panel. Oleinik explains that there is just one main aim of the scientific process: to reduce the amount of sunlight reflected by the glass surface. Normally that's about 10%. The invention was tested on the rooftop solar panels at the Institute of Physical Energetics in Riga last year. Peter Šipkaus is the head of Energy Resource Laboratory at the Institute.
We saw that on sunny days, the efficiency of solar panels with the new glass coating increased by 2.13 to 4% when compared to the usual PV panels. This is quite a remarkable number because the solar panels are able to convert only 14 to 16% of the sun's energy into electricity.
Scientists have different ways of how to increase efficiency. One is about the cell technology itself, then we have better glass structures, and the third case is through grid inverter or also solar charge controllers.
That's Aleksandrs Bērziņš from the Solar Energy Association of Latvia.
In this case, I was quite astonished about this 2 to 4%, which I did not expect from glass technology.
Though scientists are trying hard to increase the output of solar panels and every percent is a great achievement, it's the price in the market for the invention which really matters for most of the people. Groglass says it still needs to do more market testing, but the price for a square meter of coated glass might go up by around 5 to 6 euros. Again, Aleksandrs Bērziņš.
If we are talking about, let's say, 100 watt panel and we would have a price for 150 euro, then with the invention of Groglass it would cost 154. This is not a big difference, yeah? So that means a good result of better efficiency for a really affordable price.
Solar energy is still relatively unknown in Latvia. Overall solar electricity output is estimated at just over 230 kilowatt hours, or a minuscule percentage of Latvia's total energy output of over 23 billion kilowatt hours. But the hope is that Groglass will be able to sell their new solar panel to other European nations, like Italy and Germany, which have a booming demand for solar electricity. Jadars Džēlzis, DW, Riga.
Still to come on Living Planet, weather extremes and Earth Hour. But now on the show, it's time for a quick look at some environment news from the past week. Here's Mark Hallam.
An expert group of marine scientists has recommended slashing global hauls of herring, anchovies and other low-rung fish species. The Lemfest Forage Fish Task Force reported this week that catches should be cut in half. Forage fish are vital to the world's oceans, providing food to larger predators. Fishing fleets are increasingly targeting them to meet growing demand for aquaculture feed. In the biggest review of its kind to date, the task force said forage fish were twice as valuable at sea as in the net, worth about $11.3 billion annually as food for popular wild predators like salmon, tuna, and cod. Poor weather has prevented a team of engineers from assessing conditions on a failed gas platform in the North Atlantic. French energy giant Total said efforts would likely resume on Thursday or Friday. The team wants to check if it's possible and safe to plug a potentially explosive leak by pumping mud into the well. Nearly 2 weeks into the accident, Total says the leak is costing it $2.5 million a day. Its Anglo-Dutch rival Shell has been forced to suspend work at platform 6 kilometres away due to fears of a growing gas cloud. Greece has put forward a plan to become Europe's largest exporter of solar energy in a bid to stimulate the country's faltering economy. Prime Minister Lukas Papadimos said this week the 20 billion euro Helios project promised to turn Greece into a European energy hub. The aim is to install 10 gigawatts of power by the middle of the century. That's roughly the same as 10 nuclear plants. Last year, European leaders said investment could help pay off Greek debt. A recent Ernst & Young index ranked Greece the sixth most attractive place in the world to invest in solar energy. And campaign groups accused the European Union this week of bowing to industry pressure to approve pesticides held up for years over environmental concerns. Europe's Pesticide Action Network said the EU's executive and member states had waved through resubmissions of dozens of rejected substances that lacked data on consumer and environmental impacts. The EU's pesticide directive prohibits data gaps. Campaigners said regulators and chemical companies skirted the directive via looser standards for resubmission, a new regulatory avenue for companies whose chemicals have been banned or withdrawn.
Mark Hallam there with the environment news. And remember, if you're interested in more of our environment content, you can find it at the new website. That's dw.de/environment. As well as audio and articles, you can check out DW TV shows like Global Ideas that brings you clever solutions to environmental problems from around the world, like how Bolivians are dealing with drought. In Paraguay, people are also suffering from a severe drought. It's due to abnormally low levels of rain attributed to the La Niña effect. More on that soon. First, though, we hear from Sam Cowie in Paraguay, where thousands of small farmers' livelihoods have been affected across the country.
Narciso Cabrera strolled through the dry fields of his small farm near Carcupe, about 60 kilometres east of Paraguay's capital, Asunción. He has worked these 8 hectares of land for the last 13 years, producing crops and keeping animals. At this time of year, Narciso's farm usually produces healthy and profitable quantities of beans, corn, pumpkin and bananas. But not this year. Life on the farm has been difficult since December. Hardly anything has grown. Narciso relies on his crops to generate an income, but also, like many small farmers in Paraguay, to feed his family and maintain his livestock.
Things have been really bad recently. 80 to 90% of our crops have been ruined. We don't have crops for ourselves. We don't have crops to sell. We've had to sell our chickens and pigs to buy food because we couldn't afford to feed them. Normally, we would feed them with what we grow. We don't know what to do.
Narciso's plight is reflected throughout Paraguay. The sparsely populated landlocked South American country is currently experiencing one of its worst droughts in modern history. Around 250,000 small farmers like Narciso's have been affected across the country. Since December, rainfall levels have matched barely 10% of the country's average for the November to March summer period. Experts attribute the low rainfall levels to the La Niña phenomena, where falling sea temperatures in the Pacific cause unusual weather patterns. Narciso shows us what remains of this year's corn and bean crops, a useless dry field of sun-scorched skeletal plants that offer nothing. His pumpkin are useless, their roots weak and undeveloped. His bananas are tiny, bright green and immature, ravaged by insects. He has been forced to buy things that he normally grows. However, the drought is also fueling an increase in food prices.
This is the worst I've ever seen. We don't have anything to sell. We're going to wait to see if we can get sweet potato. Until then, we're just doing whatever jobs we can to get money. Otherwise, we'll have to wait until next year's harvest.
In January, Paraguayan President Fernando Lugo declared a state of emergency. The Paraguayan Red Cross began delivering food packages to the most at-risk families. Edgar Myriga, a meteorologist and director of the Ministry of Agriculture's Risk Department, says small farming families like Narciso's are particularly vulnerable to La Niña.
The small farming families are more vulnerable because they don't have the same access to technology and are less prepared than the big firms. They are also less likely to have farming insurance. The drought hit right when the crops needed the rain, so it's had a huge effect. In 2 weeks, half the crops were lost.
But it's not just the small farmers who are hurting. The broader economy has suffered too, more so than its neighbours. Paraguay relies heavily on agriculture and cattle, exporting beef and soybeans to new markets like China and India. Around 60% of the country's crops have been lost and expected growth rates have halved. The private sector estimates losses are over $1 billion, a considerable amount for one of Latin America's poorest countries, with a population of around 6 million.
The drought will have a huge impact and affect the income of Paraguay. We don't know the exact figures yet. The Central Bank of Paraguay is waiting for the evaluations, but we know it will be really bad.
Narciso has just about managed to keep his family and farm afloat this year, mainly thanks to the unusually high success of one of his crops that was unaffected by the drought, honey. Without the honey to sell, he dreads to think what might have happened.
Without the honey, I'd be hawking newspapers in Asunción. You wouldn't find me here.
Paraguay's harvesting season ends shortly, and with the onset of winter, it won't be possible to plant any more seeds. For many small families across Paraguay, the effects of this year's drought will be long felt. Sam Cowie, DW, Asunción, Paraguay.
Last year was an especially bad year for weather extremes like the drought in Latin America. Reinsurance companies, the companies that insure the insurance industry, have a big stake in keeping track of natural disasters. And they say weather extremes are taking up a growing share of their payouts. Kate Laycock presents this report by DW's Fabian Schmidt.
Tornadoes, storms, hurricanes, flooding, landslides, droughts. Natural disasters around the globe are becoming more expensive for the insurance industry. Peter Herper researches risks for Munich Re, the world's biggest reinsurance company. He says that since the 1970s, there's been a clear trend towards higher damages linked to weather extremes.
2011 was the second highest year for weather-related natural disasters. The year 2005 was the worst. It was an extreme hurricane year with Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, as the storms were called, causing huge damage.
Just last week, Swiss Re, the world's second largest reinsurer, estimated that disasters like the floods in Thailand cost the world economy $370 billion, of which insurance companies had to cover $116 billion. Many of the damages were caused by extreme weather events that scientists say were linked to two familiar weather cycles acting in sync. La Niña in the southern hemisphere, and in the northern hemisphere, a pattern of atmospheric pressure called the North Atlantic Oscillation that influences winter weather. Andreas Becker is a climatologist at the German Weather Service.
Bei La Niña ist es im globalen Mittel sicherlich eher zu feucht.
With La Niña, the world center is usually too damp, but that doesn't mean that it rains a lot all over the world. Some regions receive unusually heavy rainfall, but there are also regions with too little rainfall.
Last year, flooding wreaked havoc in Pakistan. Australia was lashed by record rainfall, whilst Southeast Asia suffered a long and heavy summer monsoon, leading to death and destruction. The Yangtze Delta in China, on the other hand, was crippled by drought, which also struck Texas in the United States. Andreas Becker says there were similar weather fluctuations in Europe too.
Norway and Scotland had their wettest year ever. Germany, Austria, Hungary and Slovakia experienced the driest November since measurements began. And spring was also extremely dry in Western Europe.
Although La Niña was a proximate cause of much of last year's destruction, Peter Herper of Munich Re says insurance data reveals a long-term climate trend underway. La Niña is the cold phase of the El Niño Southern Oscillation, a climate pattern determined by fluctuations in the surface temperature of the Pacific Ocean. Herper points out that 2011 was the hottest La Niña on record.
It warmed to an absolute maximum. Over the last 100 years, we can see that temperatures amid these oscillations are only going up. You can only explain that in the long term with climate change.
Herper added that insurance damages caused by extreme weather are growing faster than damages linked to natural disasters like earthquakes, which have nothing to do with climate change. Kate Laycock, DW.
Finally today to Earth Hour. Last weekend saw millions of people around the world turn off their lights for a symbolic moment. In 2007, the Worldwide Fund for Nature convinced millions of Australians to take a stand on climate change by switching off their lights for 1 hour. Since then, the event has spread around the world, drawing millions of participants from dozens of countries. Cinnamon Nippard went along to Earth Hour in Berlin.
Each year on the 31st of March, the WWF asks people to switch off their lights for 1 hour to raise awareness about climate change. In Berlin, it's been a blustery, rainy spring day with a sprinkling of snow. Despite the cold and wind, a few hundred people have gathered in front of the Brandenburg Gate, where the WWF have made a world map with 5,000 candles.
They are special candles made of environmental-friendly oil, so no palm oil was used there. And yeah, it's symbolizing the globe and that climate change is a global problem and we have to find global solutions to this.
That's WWF spokesperson Sylvia Ratzlaff. At 8:30, the beautifully lit Brandenburg Gate goes dark.
The really amazing thing about Earth Hour is that, you know, like, it's traveling around the globe because it's always at 8:30 local time. So you have a real wave of action that's going around the world. And we have landmarks that everyone knows, like Buckingham Palace, we have Big Ben, we have the Eiffel Tower, we have the Sydney Opera House, we have in Peking the Bird's Nest Olympic Stadium, we have the Chinese Wall, we have the highest building in the world in Dubai, a skyscraper. So it's really a global movement.
This year, 6,494 cities in 150 countries took part, making it the biggest Earth Hour event so far. New countries to take part included Libya, Bhutan, French Guinea, and Algeria. In Berlin, the crowd was diverse.
I'm from Berlin. My name is Fanny. And this is...
I'm Hector. I'm from Colombia.
And why did you guys come down tonight?
Well, it's quite a remarkable moment during the year where everybody just... try to do something for the planet.
We were just really excited to be in a city that was celebrating something that we both think is really important, and we really wanted to show our support.
Well, we came here because I thought it's a very important thing. It's very important to take part at this very special moment, and that's why we're here tonight.
And have you taken part in previous years? Have you turned off your lights at home?
Yes, we did. We switched off everything at home before to come here,
before
yes.
Before to come here, we did, actually, yeah.
And have you participated before?
No, I haven't. That's the first time I heard about it.
So I participate here in the Earth Day also for the first time to save the planet a little bit.
And do you think an action like this will make a difference?
Only 1 hour. It's more like symbolic, I think.
Even though Earth Hour is a symbolic gesture, Ratzlaff from the WWF hopes that they will inspire people to make changes in their everyday lives.
They can, you know, buy regional food maybe, buy biological food, think about their meat consumption, and they can maybe use their bike more often, they can reduce traveling by airplane. All those are steps which you can do in order to reduce your personal CO2 footprint.
Cinnamon Nippard with that look at Earth Hour there. And that's all for this week's show. If you want to leave us feedback, please do. We'd love to hear from you. The email address is livingplanet@dw.de. By the way, we realise there have been some problems with the podcast in recent weeks. They're related to the new web design, but we hope we've ironed them out now. So here's hoping you're listening to me on your MP3 player right now. I'm Nathan Woodcock. Till next week. Aber ist mir egal, ich nenn dich lieber Sunny.
nicht mehr da.